Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. We are live Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern from Studio M in Los Angeles. I am Stephen Spear, and this is TalkRadio1.com for Saturday, the 5th day of February, 2022. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. The subject of today's show is death. Mine, yours, everyone's. Well, a whole bunch of people just decided to skip this podcast. For those of you who are still with us, I'm really glad. Because since that's the subject, and because that subject makes a lot of folks, I guess, jumpy, I'm going to do something I've never done before. I'm going to give you some advice as to when to listen to this particular show. If you're ready now, if you're curious, if you're interested, if that subject kind of reaches out and grabs you, then listen to it now. That's simple. If it's not of interest and you say, I just don't need to think about that now, I'll think about that later, then wait. But keep track of the date of this show, February 5, 2022, so you can find it when you need it in the TalkRadio1.com archives. If you're not sure, then listen now because, well, none of us really know what day is our last. And there's one other reason to listen now. Not only will we talk today about emotionally preparing to die, but we're going to talk about how that very preparation can help us know better how to live. That's the real reason for today's show. That's the real reason for the conversation. Death will come to us all. Look around at any gathering of people, anywhere, anytime. Come back to that same place in 100 years, all new people. None of us is getting out of here alive. Death is inevitable. We all know that, of course, but not everyone actually internalizes that unavoidable and undeniable fact. Many of us live believing that it's far in the future, and it might be, but then find themselves unprepared when death is near, resulting in unnecessary suffering, or at least throughout their lives, lost opportunity. To explore how we might just integrate the fact of our someday death into our daily life in a way that inspires and uplifts and improves that daily life, it is my pleasure to welcome the author of Making Friends with Death, a field guide for your impending last breath, to be read ideally before it's imminent, to a conversation which has the potential to improve our personal experience here on Earth. Laura Pritchett, welcome to TalkRadio1.com.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. And here's another first, because I've never asked this as my first question of any guest in any of the over 600 shows I've done here on TalkRadio1.com. Here's my first question. Why did you write this book?
Because death is scary and I don't want to do it. But truly because I went through a period of time when I was really, really, really fearful of dying. And by dying, I mean the whole shebang of dying, the decline, the potential pain, the absence of my soul or myself, my Laura-ness, and the afterlife and what my death would mean for my kids. And I just kept saying, I object. I am totally against this idea. So I turned to books because I'm an author, a novelist, and so I turned to books for some wisdoms, and I found that there were literally no good books out there. I can talk about what good books are out there, but there was none that were like a practical how-to general guide for the general everyday Joe mortal. So I wrote one.
Dr. Laura Pritchett has a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and a PhD in English, and is unsurprisingly the author of short stories and a half dozen books, including both novels and nonfiction. Laura has won multiple awards for those multiple works, which works have appeared in dozens of publications, including everything from the New York Times to Teen Magazine, from O Magazine to Salon. I asked Laura to join me today because her work, her book, Making Friends with Death, is thoughtful and reflective, and death can be a sensitive subject, especially when it's near. Laura, you started Making Friends with Death with a story that you tell, which startled me, and I guess startled you, from when you were about 14 years of age, about a human skull. Would you go ahead and tell that story?
Oh, boy, that's a doozy. But yeah, when I grew up on a ranch in northern Colorado, my father was a professor of genetics, cattle genetics. And so we had this ranch, and on this ranch was an old pioneer cemetery. And it was all full of weeds. And my mom had spent her whole lifetime kind of cleaning it up and researching about who had been buried there, and did a fantastic amount of work there. But at one point in time, there was a big rainstorm, and a coffin was in danger of falling into a ditch. And so she made all of her kids get up and go help move the coffin inland so it wouldn't fall in the ditch, which was a respectful thing to do, of course. But in the process, she also decided to lift the lid and take out the skull of a man who we later learned his name was Jay Thomas, and he had been buried in the 1870s. And his skull stayed in the house for a very long time. She took it out. We later reburied it. But that was the kind of ranch it was, full of skulls and raccoons and peacocks and canaries flying around the house. So it was an interesting childhood that introduced me early to death.
You described that over 140 people were buried in that cemetery that had been operated from 1862 to into the 1890s, and that it was a place where no one ever paid for a burial space, and no one kept records, and no one was responsible for its care until your mother came along. And she looked at it not as a morbid necrology, but a celebration of ordinary lives. Your mom had a very interesting view of death and life all by herself, didn't she?
Well, she did. And I'm so glad I grew up with this attitude of very no-nonsense, practical. This is what it is. We had calves dying and kitty cats dying. And, you know, ranch life is full of death. It's also full of birth and life and beautiful thing, but it's all handled in a very no-nonsense, practical kind of way, which I appreciate. And I think so many Americans actually have gotten away from that. And we forget just that without death, there's no life. I mean, we need to die and animals die, and we just might as well face it.
At page 14 of the introduction, you say, "I tell this story because of this. I have a clear and bright memory of standing above this body and being possessed with a sudden intense fear of death and a simultaneous odd wish to die well. I was heartbroken with the idea that I had to die. Somehow, at that brief, nuanced nanosecond, death was no longer a stranger. You could say, I guess, that I grew up in that one clear moment and became aware of my mortality." And I want to tell you a story, and Laura, I've told this story a couple of times over the last 15 years here on this station. And that was when I was 17 years old. You were 14 at the time of this experience. I was 17, and I had a friend named Hal, and Hal's father and my father had a lot of similarities. They were the same age. They were both physicians. They both were in solo medical practice. They both drove dark brown 1969 Buick Electras, and there were so many interesting parallels between the two of them. And then one day, when Hal was 17 and I was 17, Hal's father had a heart attack and he died. Mm-hmm. And it was shocking because with only one other exception, none of our friends our age had fathers who had died, and Hal's father was now dead. And Hal asked the question out loud a number of times, "Why my father?" And I realized, of course, this could have been my father, and I adored my father, and the thought of even the possibility that he would die someday would bring tears to my eyes. And it changed my relationship with my father, who lived for another 20 years after that. And then it changed my entire attitude toward life and the view I came away with, and I'm told by some this is morbid, but it really, it's life-affirming, is that anytime I have a conversation with anyone or see anyone, a loved one, a stranger, anyone, it's clear to me, I'm conscious of the fact it could be the last time I ever see them or they ever see me, because one of us might die. And that changed me in the way you describe, and in the passage I just read, in that I had a different view of life as a result of that death. Give me whatever reaction you have to that.
Well, that's a beautiful story, and it brings home the point. I think the overall take-home point of my book is use death as your advisor. Use it on how to live. Live fully. Don't be distracted. Don't get petty. Don't forget to be grateful for this day. And using daily reminders of our death, I think, keeps us living bright and true and honest and kind. Amen to that. Yeah.
There are three objectives that I was able to discern from Making Friends with Death, your excellent book. And by the way, congratulations. Excellent. I recommend this book, ladies and gentlemen. You can buy it here now on the talkradio1.com website. Click on the icon, buy the book. This is, whether you read it now or you read it later, but again, read it sooner than later because you don't know when later is. But this is a really worthwhile, thought-provocative book that has some very weird things in it, some very reassuring things in it. And I found myself having an unusual range of emotions as I read the book because it brought forth feelings, other nuanced feelings I hadn't experienced before. So really, congratulations on it.
Thank you so much. And I hope you laughed a little because
I did.
If there's one thing we could do is bring humor into this discussion too.
You are a funny writer, yes.
Well, this whole situation is kind of humorous and crazy and ridiculous.
So there are three objectives I was able to discern. One is to prepare for death. I'm not talking about necessarily just finances and putting papers in order, but emotionally preparing for death. And the other one is, as we've said, how to live our remaining days. And the third one is you give some incredibly practical homework, a bunch of things that we can actually do to raise awareness. And this book becomes as much a book of how to live as it is how to die. To paraphrase Caitlin Doughty, the author of Ask a Mortician, who you quote at page 32 of your book, don't be as afraid of dying. Be afraid of how you're living. And I'm going to give you five quotes from your book at different places that'll, I think, set the stage for where we're all headed next with this conversation. You quote Shakespeare on page one of your book, "Be prepared for death, and death or life shall thereby be the sweeter." You quote Mark Twain at page 63, "Fear of death follows fear of life. A man who lives fully is prepared to die at any time." You quote Shakespeare at page 95, "But that the dread of something after death, the undiscovered country from which no traveler returns, puzzles the will." You quote Peter Pan at page 151, "To die will be an awfully big adventure." And then I'm going to quote you from page 247, "Our job is to sharpen life in order to soften death." So one of the things that happens that you talk about are mistakes that people made. I'll give you a quote and get your reaction on the other side. This is from page 16. "With modern medicine, there's certainly less suffering than there used to be, and that's a good thing. Yay for morphine. In certain ways, though, I'd argue that often there's more suffering than there needs to be, and that we're prolonging life just to prolong life. As one example, many of us want to die calmly at home, but despite our good intentions, we often say yes to surgeries or interventions at the very, very end because we are afraid of death. Or the people around us are unsure what to do, and the easiest thing to do is call 911. And this is tricky."
I love those quotes, and I think that's so true. We are just not getting the death that we want. And some of that is out of our control, but some of it is. For example, just to add to that, 75% of people say they want to die at home and 25% do. And 70% say they want low intensity care, but only 42% get their wish. So that's a real problem because partly because of our medical system, and I'm not dissing anyone or doctors or palliative care folks who are doing wonderful work, but it's partly because we haven't communicated what a good death looks like for us, and we haven't put things in place to make it happen.
So those two statistics you gave come from the CDC, and you talk about them in your book, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, that we've heard so much about in the last couple of years. And you gave two of the statistics. I'll give another couple of them from that same page in your book. 82% of people say it's important to write their wishes out, but only 23% have done it. 81% of people say they want to talk with their doctor about their end-of-life care, and 7% have actually had that conversation. And so we don't handle it. We don't step out and do it. Most people have some plan in their lives and organize things so that they can get what they want and after they get what they need from life. But it doesn't seem that this takes enough of a priority. One resource I interviewed, Ken Ross and Diane Gray from the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross Foundation. And if you're interested, ladies and gentlemen, you can find that interview February 6, 2010, February 6, 2010, here in the talkradio1.com archives and website. And you quote Elizabeth Kubler-Ross at page 17 of your book, saying there are many reasons for this flight away from facing death calmly. One of the most important facts is that dying nowadays is more gruesome in many ways, namely more lonely, more mechanical, and more dehumanized. And she said that in the 1960s. It's even more so now. And of course, COVID has made it even worse, where people are alone and can't be connected with in the hospital. It's even harder. But it used to be that we didn't know why people died. People nowadays, when you hear someone died, the first question is, how did they die? But it used to be that death was more opaque and people just died. Now we have all of these things that keep people from being dead, these medical systems that can help extend life, but sometimes don't extend it with a purpose. So we're more removed from death than we've ever been, in a way.
That's absolutely true. And the best thing we can do is reclaim it. And the first step of doing that, I think, is to write down what you think is a good death for you and then share that with somebody so that it's not sitting on your computer or in a notebook no one will ever find. But, you know, for example, I've just been really clear. I've written down, what do I want my death to look like? I know I might not get it. You know, things happen. But if I have a choice, I want to die outside or with a view of nature. I want my medical wishes respected. I want to be communicated with honestly. And then even little things like I want to be surrounded by the color blue and the smell of roses or basil. I want to have a favorite song playing. I want pain relief. I want to have honest people with me. Just writing down these really basic things, I think, can help you point your ship in the direction of a good death and away from the pull of the technology and medical system, which is not bad. Again, I'm not dissing it, but you've got to decide at critical moments what it is you want and when.
Seems like one of those decisions has to be whether you want to continue to get care in a situation where that's a choice. Another round of chemotherapy or another surgery or another procedure or set of procedures that you need to suffer through. And then the question is, toward what? What happens next? I have an uncle, a dear, dear, dear man who is now 98 years old. And when he was 94, he was told that he had to make a fast decision to have his left arm removed just below the shoulder, because he had cancer in his left arm, which was extremely active and metastatic, and that if it was removed, he could live for a long time, or I guess as long as you might live when you're 94, or if he kept the arm, then they would make him comfortable and he would be gone very shortly. He elected to have the arm removed, and it's been an adventure for the last 5 years, four and a half, 5 years since then, that has been some good and some bad. But different people would make different choices at different times, and a lot of times it seems that those choices are driven by the excellent medical system that, when it works, keeps us alive and allows us to survive and then have perhaps many years of enjoyment afterwards, and other times keeps us alive when perhaps we're staying alive for something that's worse.
Well said, exactly. Staying alive to what purpose? And I think we need to be clear about DNRs and what our medical wishes and should be, or what we want them to be. And in part, this is a great gift to our family, because I think we all know stories where families have been torn apart, siblings not talking to each other, or spouses hating each other because they were fighting up to the very end because they didn't know what the dying person wanted. Did they want to be on life support? For how long? Did they want to be resuscitated or not? And if we can be clear about those wishes and share them, then we are really protecting our loved ones from a lifetime of regret or sorrow or not knowing, doubting themselves, doubting their decisions. And what a horrible burden to put on people we love.
I grew up in a family where this was discussed openly, and my father, as a physician, practiced medicine for 45 years. And so this was a discussion, a daily discussion, frequent discussion of people who died and people who made mistakes on their way to death and people who made better decisions and worse decisions. So my sister and my mother and I, when my father was dying, we had no doubt. We had no doubt as to what he would want. And I remember sitting with the doctors about a dozen days before my dad died, and I was sitting behind my sister and my mother, who were both facing the doctor as I was. And the doctor said, well, not in answer to a question, he just in discussing alternatives, he said, we could reduce the morphine. My dad was dying of cancer. And he said, we could reduce the morphine and he could be awake, so you could speak with him and he could speak with you, but he would be in pain. And the doctor kept on talking for another moment or two, and I could see in front of me, my sister's and my mother's heads were shaking, shaking in the negative, that no, we don't want to wake him up. And I, of course, knew that as well. Because we all knew what we had all said, all the things over the decades that we wanted to say, and had heard all the things that there were to hear. And so we all knew, no, we don't need to do that. That was a comforting moment. And when I asked the doctor about it weeks later after my father had died, he said most people are torn at that moment and have a big discussion, and then sometimes they have big arguments and they have problems with each other. We should wake him up. We don't want to wake him up. That's easy for you to say. You didn't have the problems I had, and so forth. And it turns into a very, very unpleasant thing where some decision is made and somebody's unhappy. And so knowing these things in advance and expecting and planning and preparing all our lives for that can result in greater peace.
That is such a beautiful story. And when I was writing this book, I would go around and ask people, have you seen a good and peaceful death? I mean, I was just curious. And I think it's something we should all ask one another at cocktail parties and dinner parties is just, have you seen a good and peaceful death? And it sounds like you have, as good as it could be. I'm sure it was full of loss and hurt and pain, but horrible. It sounds quite beautiful.
It's still my father's illness and his death still, and I feel very lucky that I, at the age of 68, I can say this, it's still the worst event of my life. And I know I'm very lucky to be able to say that, but it was the worst, it remains to this day, the worst event of my life. And yet, as you say, there was a beauty to it. There was a beauty to it.
I think that's very rare and a wonderful story to hear.
Sometimes the best thing to do to prepare for our own death is to examine the thing with which we have more experience. And of course, none of us, neither you nor I on this show, nor anyone listening to it, has had the experience of death ourselves because we haven't died. And as far as I know, no one's actually come back to describe the whole experience to us to come back in person and talk with us about it. So the experience that many of us have had is the death of another, the death of parents, the death of grandparents, the death of other people. And you discuss that starting in chapter 2 of making friends with death. And you give a list at page 93 of some of the things we can do to help with other people who are dying. And this is near and dear and current to my heart because a very good friend of ours, and in particular of mine, a woman who worked for me for a lot of years in my law office as our calendar manager, died just a week ago. And after a long battle with cancer at the age of 51 and with two young children. So it's difficult, but I've very recently been here. And you have this list at page 93 of things to do, things that you can do to prepare for someone else's death. One of the things you say is show up and listen. I'm going to go through this list. Just give me a thumbnail on each thing, if you would. Show up and listen.
Well, first of all, thanks for pointing out this list. I just want to quickly say the book is broken up in death prep for yourself and then death prep to help someone else die. And I really do like this chapter because it felt really practical and helpful to me as more people in my life start to die. So just showing up, I just say, play the role of the confident guest and create a good holding environment. Don't show up with your anxieties. Don't show up freaking out. Show up for this person, calm and collected and ready to accept and hold their emotions. I think that is the greatest thing we can do for someone else.
Talk and talk about death when you can and be honest.
Yeah, that's point number two. And I tell this story where my sister was an EMT and she would be in the back of the ambulance taking people in and or getting ready to transport them. And people would say, shh, you know, don't talk. It's going to be okay. And in part, that's understandable. You're trying to calm someone down. But in some cases, the person was about to die. They needed a chance to talk. They needed a chance to say a few things. So I mean that. But I also mean talking about it in our culture, making death a prevalent topic of conversation feels really important, and letting them talk about their emotions and not trying to shush them or say silly things like, oh, it's going to be okay. Or just think about this time, well, you'll be in Mexico next year when they might not be in Mexico next year, you know, like be honest, be an honest talker.
This is something that I read this book in the past week since my friend died, and when I saw this I was very glad. I didn't have your instruction and your excellent guidance for this, but it was something that she and I did over the past year and a half that she was quite ill, is we would get together and have lunch and have conversation, and we would talk about her upcoming death. Once it became clear in the last few months that she was going to die, they had stopped chemotherapy and were simply in palliative care, that she was going to die, then we spoke frankly about her family and her finances and what would happen after her and how she viewed it. There were some beautiful conversations. They helped her. They helped me. You say advocate for their medical care and advocate for pain relief.
Yeah. And that's a no-brainer, but it takes a good friend or a good loved one to really pay attention to options and what the doctors are saying. And as we all know, and you might have something to say about this yourself, given your recent experience, but when you're feeling lousy, you don't have the bandwidth to really ask for what you might need. So that's our job.
I think that's right. And I have two comments on that. The first one is, I think that many, many people have appropriately a resistance to taking a whole bunch of drugs all the time. You want to avoid, natural is the best way. You want to make yourself healthy through nutrition and exercise and not through medication where that's possible. I say that as a person who takes a handful of medications every day and have for years, and they're very good for me, and so I take them. But we all have, and I have, a resistance to adding another one or to taking things for pain when they're not necessary. And so I think a lot of times in end-of-life scenarios, people have tremendous unnecessary suffering because they are resistant to opiates at a time when being addicted to opiates is not a bad thing. And the opiates are very, very good at doing the job they do, which is the suppression of pain, which becomes a very important thing in some late stages of dying. The second thing, you referred to the experience I recently have, and for those people, pick this show up from all different sorts of sources, and so sometimes they're just listening to one show because they did a search for one subject. So I will share that I was a year ago in the hospital for 15 days with COVID, and for 12 of those 15 days, I was kind of on the bubble where each day the doctors said plainly to me repeatedly, well, Steve, you could wake up tomorrow and be breathing room air and go home, or you could wake up tomorrow and be on a ventilator. And I understood that meant, and therefore die, probably. And so for 12 of those 15 days, I was in the hospital. I talk about that at length in a show that you can find here on talkradio1.com at January 30, 2021. January 30, 2021. That was 6 days after I got out of the hospital, and I go through in what has been called by many of my listeners excruciating detail the entire hospital experience, but I would say that it's a great way to learn about COVID in a way you cannot learn about it from the fragmented news coverage in any kind of media. So that experience, you are right, Laura, that gave me an insight, and it's, I believe, as far as I know, the closest I came to dying, because I guess I was within a day of dying for a dozen days. And so, yeah, it was a place where I got some insight.
I bet. And I hope we can return to that. I have more questions, so many questions.
Well, go ahead. That's great. Let's do that now.
Well, I assume that's the closest you've been to death.
As far as I know, yes. I mean, who knows, when I was standing somewhere where a minute later a rock fell, you know, I don't know. But in my awareness, yes, the closest I've ever been to death.
And so did your relationship with death change? Did you have moments of fear or peace?
Interestingly, it was peace. The only upset that was throughout it was what's going to happen with my wife, with my children. Now, my children are all grown and they're married and they have kids of their own and they're doing great, and I'm no longer necessary. I'm beneficial in their lives, but I'm not necessary. In my wife's life, I'm far more necessary because I'm a feature of her daily life. And she had COVID at home while I had COVID, so I was worried about her. And of course, my kids rallied to try to make sure she was monitored, and they did a beautiful job of that. But I was upset over all of the people who would be upset if I died. For myself, I had two feelings. One is, I was at peace with dying. If I died, I'd die. I didn't want to suffer, so that was a fear. I didn't want to... that was it. I didn't want to suffer. For me, that was it. And the other piece was, I wanted to live. I like my life. I like just about every day of my life a lot. and I like the things I do with my life, and I like the things I'm going to be doing with my life if things go well. And so I wanted to live. But if that was the end of my road, I was 67 years old, and if that was the end, I felt so blessed, so lucky to have had the life, the partners, the friends, the wife, the children, the career, the opportunities, the parents, my sister, all my dear lifelong business partner and close friend, very close friend, John Woodward, all of these people. I felt so fortunate that I didn't feel shortchanged. If I died, I'd be fine with it. But I knew they wouldn't be. So that was upsetting. But no, it didn't change, because my view of death is, I think, as I read your book, very similar to yours. I've lived with death since Hal's father died. And so, no, not surprised. I'm not surprised by the fact that it didn't change.
That's lovely. And it reminds me of the Twain quote that you quoted earlier about if you're, you'll be prepared to die because you've lived fully.
Yes.
It
is a fear of death follows fear of life. A man who lives fully is prepared to die at any time.
Nice.
Did you have other things you wanted to ask about that experience before we move on? Because I know you listened to that show, and thank you for that, before this one.
Well, of course. Well, it just sounds like such a harrowing experience, and you were so honest about it. And that's one great thing about your show is I just like people who talk practically and honestly and open-hearted about all sorts of things. But also, I have to say, I learned more about COVID from your show than I have from a lot of other news reports. I mean, just how it feels in the body. So I just thank you for the gift of that show.
That is the most frequent comment I've gotten about that show, is that people said, I had no idea from the news coverage. I had no idea how the hospitals operated or what COVID felt like or what the experience was, because everybody hears that it's now farther away because it's been 2 years and we're all tired of it. But you heard that at about day 10, people took a turn, and they either took a turn for the better and got better, or they took a turn for the worse, and then they died. Well, I took a turn for the worse and didn't die. And a lot of people took a turn for the worse and didn't die. But that wasn't very well publicized, so everybody was terribly frightened and waiting for the 10th day after onset of symptoms, and thinking that this must be how it worked. It isn't. And so listen to that show, January 30, 2021. Back to your list for helping other people. You said advocate for relief of their spiritual and emotional pain.
Yeah, you know, I say advocate for their medical care and pain relief, but don't forget their need spiritual and emotional care too. And so I just pose a bunch of questions, you know, that frankly I wish I would have thought of when my dad was dying or when friends died. But how can you take care of them and hug them in one way or another? For example, can you bring a pet in to visit them, or certain flowers or pictures or music? Can you rub their feet? Can you set up mementos, perhaps even write an obituary with them that celebrates their life, that's in their voice? I think you can help them figure out whom to contact and in what order and how to announce the death if they're open to it. I mean, I think talking about it ultimately there at the end does help alleviate spiritual and emotional pain. And as I say, I just wanted to read this quote. It's contingent upon you to help them let go. There will be different levels of acceptance, both from you and the dyer, but try your best to lead by example. And remember, letting go is not a sign of insufficient love. It's mature love. Because I think in our society, we have this sense that we got to keep everyone alive and medical. And again, it's sometimes a mature love is helping let them go.
You talk about things not to do. And the two that stand out to me besides the one you already said, which is don't let your own fears or your own sorrows get that person down. You say, do not yak about your religion if it doesn't coincide with the dying person's religion. And and do not pretend that death isn't happening. This is something that I've seen happen a number of times when people are dying, that where I've witnessed illness and so forth, that people try to tell the dying person, don't worry, because this is how it works, because the person speaking has a strong belief as to how it works. And the person who's dying, very frequently, I've been in the position to know, as the speaker knew, that that person doesn't agree with that. But it doesn't stop the speaker from, I don't know, proselytizing.
And what a bad time for that, in my humble opinion. I mean, of course, dying is going to bring up spiritual beliefs. They're very connected, and it matters very much what you believe, what comes after death. That will influence and inform your death and how you approach death. But I think it's a great disservice to someone to come up and start talking to them about your particular religion when they don't share that religious view. I think I personally would be so annoyed. In fact, I have a list of instructions if I'm in the hospital, and there's certain things about things that I do not allow. And one of them is religious figures in my room at the end. They wouldn't serve me. It would add to angst, not comfort.
What else don't you want to have happen in your last hours?
Oh, that's a good question. I hope that I'm not being, there's just so many ways of dying. One is more of a meandery death, and one is a sudden death. And I have this hope that I'm not being poked and prodded and stabbed. But if it's a sudden death, like a car crash, that might be the case. You know, there might be doctors trying to save me. So I've come to peace with that. But if I prefer to be conscious and outside and, with the people and things I love around me. So, I think, though, for me, religion has been such a trigger in my life that would be the number one thing I wouldn't want, is someone coming in to bless me or something, when that it's not what I want.
And by that, you mean you are not a religious person. And so someone who is religious promoting their religion to you at that time is not something that would comfort you.
Yeah, I say I'm a card carrying nothing. I leaned into Buddhism in a bit in this book, because if anyone has good books on dying, it's the Buddhists. But I'm not a card-carrying Buddhist. I'm not a card-carrying anything. So, and I distrust people generally who do say they know the answer. So I just ask that you respect my beliefs when I'm dying. At the most critical moment of, as the last physical act of my life, I really want to do it well. I want to do it peacefully, and I want it to be on my terms. So I do not want somebody coming in to talk to me about what I should have believed or didn't believe, but am now damned because I didn't believe, or all the various subsets of that conversation.
So what you have is a list, and there are exercises throughout the book, Making Friends with Death, questions people can ask themselves, exercises they can do, homework, you call it. And you have an entire section of homework, and it's very helpful, I think, for people who need additional substance and structure to it. I think that's worthwhile. I was struck personally by the fact I don't personally need all of those answers. I think some of them were important, and I found that most of them I'd thought of, a couple that I hadn't, I did then think about them. And other people will really want to make a project out of it. Other people will want to won't need to. It's not necessary. And I think this is one of the nice things about what I'll call your curriculum here, because people can select what they like and leave what they don't. One of the things that you talk about is a death mantra. What is a death mantra? And for the people who should have one, why should they have one?
Well, that's my favorite little homework myself, that and writing a goodbye letter to life. The death mantra, to my mind, means those last little phrases you'll say to yourself and as you blink out of consciousness, and that hopefully bring you peace. And again, maybe you won't have that choice, but you might. And so instead of saying, oh, dang, or oh, cuss word, you know, or dang it, I'd rather think of my kids' smiles or the mountains, or even say, hello, great unknown, or, you know, on to the next great adventure, I guess. You know, I'd rather have some things practiced in my mind, ready to go at that last moment. And it's my belief that if you form those words in advance and practice them from time to time, they will come more naturally to you in your moment of need.
I analogize this to what I'll do many times to fall asleep at night. And I find that I can fall asleep literally within 2 minutes of turning out the lights and putting my head on the pillow, literally within 2 minutes, and many times within 1 minute. And that is a series of thoughts that I run through that are really very pleasant and very calming. And so this death mantra struck me. I'd never heard of it or thought of it before, but your notion of it struck me as being something very useful for calming one's self, so that there isn't that fright, that tension, or what do I do, or what do I do with myself? Kind of like when sometimes people are standing up in front of a crowd and they don't know what to do with their hands. You know, do I fold my arms? Do I put them in my pocket? Do I clasp them behind my back? And people who do public speaking a lot have to figure that out and know what they do with their hands. And it's what you need to do with your mind when you're trying to fall asleep, or perhaps when you're preparing to die. So I really, that the death mantra struck me as being something for that purpose. Not, and I know some people would view it as some sort of a prayer or some sort of an action item. I'm looking at it as a self-calming, self-centering exercise.
Oh, I love that. Can I just ask a few of the images that you call to mind? Is it, for example, a beach or a... I'm just regular, curious. I want to try it. I'm an insomniac.
Well, regular listeners to this show know that one of my the purpose of this show is to help people navigate through life, to find experts like you, Laura Pritchett, who have really, really thought about a subject and have researched it and have really taken the trouble to establish a way of thinking to help people navigate through life. But another thing in which I completely indulge myself is Disney parks and Disneyland and Walt Disney World. So I've got, I don't know, out of the 600 shows that are on the talkradio1.com website now, I'd say probably, oh, at least 60 or 80 of them are about Disneyland or Disney World or something to do with Disney park operations one way or another, which also is a way to help people, because I think the Disney parks can be a magnificent a backdrop for family activity. And at Disney World, for example, a week-long conversation with your family, and at Disneyland, a day or two long visit with your family where you can direct conversations and really get meaning and depth out of it. It's not just riding the rides. So when I'm trying to fall asleep at night, and I imagine part of my death mantra will be thinking about time at and experiences at Disney parks. There are plenty of other things that take a higher position than that. That one struck me funny, so I mentioned it first. But thinking about my children, my grandchildren, my wife, my business partners, my friends, my sister, my family, her family, all of these just lazily drifting through thinking about things, conversations, experiences with them. These are all very relaxing and comforting for me. So since they are in life, I imagine they will be near death.
It sounds like it. And then you'll get a good smile out of all that. And yes, that's really what I think, we want to die with a smile on our face if we can, right?
It was interesting to me to hear that you would like to die if you could outdoors, and I wouldn't think of dying out. I'm an indoor cat.
I was just going to say, I teach, I'm a professor of nature writing at Western Colorado University to graduate students, and my whole life is nature and books about nature. And so
Yes.
Yeah. My final moments will certainly be about being outside or thinking about being outside.
Yeah. There's no question in my mind. And I know that you are, that your work is rooted in the American West and issues of ecology and conservation and climate change and so forth. So when it became clear in your book and here today, when you said you'd like to, when you die, you'd like to be outdoors, I thought, well, that makes perfect sense, but it never would occur to me to be outdoors. I'll take a hospital than outdoors. So
that's why it's good we let somebody know, right? Because how they sense it. We're all so different.
That's exactly right. Well, and this is why there are 31 flavors. You know,
exactly.
It would be if there was one correct flavor, it would be called Baskin-Robbins flavor. And that would be that. One of the things that I took for granted because my father was a physician is that how you knew when someone was going to die, because I'm sure that when I was 6 or 8 or 10 years old, on one of the many visits with him to the hospital on Sundays, we would spend time together. We would go to the hospital together. He would see patients. And back in those days, before the HIPAA privacy requirements, where he thought that it would be beneficial to the patient, he would bring me in and I would talk with the patient, with him. And this is something like today, people bring dogs to hospitals to visit with patients, and it's been shown conclusively to be very helpful. And my dad had figured out in the 50s and 60s that bringing a young, happy child to talk with an older, sicker person actually helped them. And I could feel it at the time. And I thought my dad was doing it exclusively for the benefit of his patients. But what I figured out as I grew up was it was for my benefit as well, because this was part of his education of me and of my sister as to life and death and all that he did and all that medicine does and the hospitals do that is overwhelmingly good. And so it was an experience there. So I asked, how do you know when someone's going to die? So I learned that. And so when I would visit people who were saying, somebody would say he's going to die this today or tomorrow. And I would say, no, it doesn't look like it. He doesn't look like he's near death. Well, how do you know? Well, you at page 65 of Making Friends with Death have a list of how you can tell when someone's going to die. And frankly, I think people would be better off knowing that list. So let's go through it. Body temperature lowers by a degree or more. Okay, well, they're constantly taking your temperature in the hospital. This is one of the reasons, so that they have that. It's one of many reasons. Blood pressure lowers. This is why when you're in the hospital, your blood pressure is taken continuously. The pulse becomes irregular and may slow down or speed up. They're constantly taking your pulse in the hospital. There is increased perspiration. This is something we can be aware of ourselves. Skin color changes as circulation becomes diminished. This is often more noticeable in the lips and nail beds as they become pale and bluish. Perhaps the most obvious change, though, will be in the breath, which is why perhaps meditation and focus on the breath can help us the most at our final moments. And of course, the reason to know all this is if you know this is coming, you'll be less frightened by the sensations. You can recognize them and peacefully ease into them. Laura, give me your thoughts.
Well, yes, I just think resisting those last moments instead of just being a dying person scares me. And I don't want to do that. I want to relax into what is happening, which is dying. I'm going to be a dying person, and I don't want to be scared by the sensations. And from there, you know, I hope to achieve peace. I think peace is an inside job, and I think we get to it often through breath and a sense of our calm and collected thoughts, which takes practice because we're humans after all. And I do like the quote I have right below that, which is Roosevelt. I write, "Nothing is so much to be feared as fear itself," said Roosevelt, paraphrasing Thoreau, who was probably paraphrasing Francis Bacon, who said, "Nothing is terrible except for fear itself." So I think we have to get past our fear.
I think that's right. And Franklin Roosevelt is much quoted in saying that. And yet I don't think that a majority of people accept the deep importance of that, is that when we are afraid, we need to identify it, be aware of it, and then calm ourselves, find a way to calm ourselves, still be in touch with the fear. But that's where courage and bravery come from. It's action in the face of fear. If you're not afraid, there's nothing brave about what you're doing. If you're not afraid, there's nothing courageous about what we're doing. We hear that people are doing courageous things when maybe they're not, because they're not afraid. They're angry, or they're whatever they are. But if we can find the fear and then figure out how to manage, not deny, not avoid, but manage the fear, we're going to be able to make forward progress in whatever we're doing, including dying. I want to come back for a moment. Well, I want to hit two other things because I know we're running low on time. First of all, a bucket list. There's a lot of talk about bucket lists and things that people want to do before they die. And I think that's a good idea. And if there are things you want to do before you die, the only time to do them is always, always, always right now. Again, because we don't know when that last day is. Any one of us might die this afternoon, and yet we might live for another 30 or 50, or depending on your age, 80 or 100 years. And so those have to be completed. I don't have a bucket list. Do you?
I love that question. You know, I've done them. I think I could die in peace now. I think my big thing on my bucket list was to be a great parent and to write these 5 novels, at least, that I knew were inside me. And I did. And of course, smaller things like travel and have adventures and love well and be loved well and those sorts of things. But I think you're right. Anytime something appears on my bucket list, I pretty much go after it and do it. And that helps.
I have my bucket list is complete as well. I think that's why I was at peace a year ago in the hospital, and why I've been at peace with my own death for really quite a long time. I wanted to be an excellent husband and father and friend and partner to my partners and lawyer to my clients and organizer for our investors. I wanted to be a great barbecuer. I wanted to be a talk show host. And I've gotten to do all of the things and many other smaller things, but I've wanted to be a brother to my sister and an uncle to my nephews and nieces. All of those things, I've gotten to do all those things, and I've reached a level of satisfaction with each of them. So get rid of your bucket list, I think, is one thing.
Great advice.
I want to come back to religion for a minute. At page 37, you talk about religion, you discuss it. And in your research and interviews, and I know I gathered from the book clearly that you are not a religious person, what connections did you see between the attitude about death in those who believe in an afterlife and those who do not?
What did I see? Well, I think, of course, the belief in an afterlife brings some people peace, but I could not say that the religious I interviewed were any less fearful of death overall. Like, I think it's human nature to resist death, our impulses to live. There is that unknown. And I think while spiritual beliefs and a belief in an afterlife can assist, can be one of the tools in that toolbox, it doesn't solve everything. Like I thought that those who had a very strong belief in the afterlife would have an easier time of it. And, you know, I didn't do any exhaustive studies, but that is not what I saw. Does that answer that question?
It does. And I've made the same observation. I know some people, a number of people, who have a very strong belief in an afterlife, and they talk about it and they speak in that language, and it's clear they feel it in their hearts. And some of them are very peaceful about death, and others are not. And what I've come up with is, and I'm not sure of this, and I'm sure it's different from person to person, but what I've come up with is the sense that even in those who are confident in an afterlife, the fear is the transition. And that, again, was one of the fears I had in the hospital. I didn't want to suffer. If I'm going to die, I didn't want to linger. I didn't want to linger and have weeks or days or hours or, for that matter, minutes of pain and suffering. If I was going to die, it wouldn't matter to me to stay alive for another day or another week or another month. I'd just soon die now if I can die painlessly. And so fear of the transition was the only fear I had for myself. As I say, I had fears for my family and friends and people who, others who rely on me. But for myself, that was the only fear I had. So I think that could explain why some people who have absolute confidence in an afterlife are still concerned about dying or death. Dying, not death.
That's so interesting. Somewhere in the book, I do say I interviewed just people haphazardly, everybody I interviewed for this book, and I asked what about death were they most afraid of? And it really came it down to three categories, each with about a third of participants saying about a third were just afraid of death, like the void or whatever comes after the end of their sense of self. You know, that's scary. A third were afraid of the suffering and transition and pain. And that feels legitimate too. And then a third were afraid for their family or loved ones, and especially children. So it's interesting you mentioned that. There are a lot of different colors of fear.
Any final thoughts or feelings that you'd like to share that I haven't covered? There's another question I never ask anyone, but I'm asking you.
Oh, thank you. I would just argue that to die as well as we can is a job of ours, and it's incumbent upon us to get some things in writing. It's to help us, to help the people we love, and to help the planet. And so just even writing down a few things today and handing it to someone just about what you want or what you don't want, how you'd best like to be celebrated, just even getting a few things down so it doesn't feel like a big overwhelming task that you've got to go make a whole day or weekend for. I mean, just a few basic thoughts and handing it to someone, I think, is the best thing you can do.
That's beautiful. And I want to say, Laura Pritchett, thank you so much for being with me today here on TalkRadio1.com. I have thoroughly enjoyed it, and I found it uplifting. I hope our audience did as well.
Yeah, let's all go live.
Exactly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guest has been author Laura Pritchett. She has written the book Making Friends with Death, a field guide for your impending last breath, to be read ideally before it's imminent. I recommend this book strongly. You can buy it right here, right now on the TalkRadio1.com website. Click on it, buy it. This is a great book, and it has workbook characteristics to it for those who want that, and some beautiful explanations of a lot of things. Very thought-provoking, and I want to say, not morbid, uplifting, and I'll also add, funny. She's a funny author. It's really good. You can also find much more about Laura Pritchett and her work at laurapritchett.com. Laura, L-A-U-R-A, Pritchett, P-R-I-T-C-H-E-T-T, laurapritchett.com. My thanks to Doug McIntyre, who interviewed Laura many years ago on Talk Radio 790 KABC in Los Angeles, when Doug was the morning host there for many years. And he did a lovely job with that. I made a note of it, and that's how I followed up and found Laura here. My next show will be two weeks from today. My guest is going to be Peter Funt. Peter Funt has been on our show twice before. He has written a new book called Self-Amused, A Tell Some Memoir. Now, Peter Funt is the son of a famous father, Alan Funt, who was the creator and host of Candid Camera, first on radio and then on television in the 50s and 60s. And Peter Funt's story is one of a man trying to make it on his own, striving and failing and succeeding. So this should be an interesting travel through life. Peter Funt, that's 2 weeks from today, Saturday, February 19, 2022, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Remember to use our Amazon link and our eBay links when you shop Amazon or eBay from the TalkRadio1.com homepage. It costs you nothing extra, and it helps support the fine programming here on TalkRadio1.com. There's another way you can do that by making a direct contribution using our PayPal link. You can make a one-time contribution or a monthly contribution, whichever suits your finances. TalkRadio1.com's goal is to keep the show streaming live and available as podcasts at no cost to you. To do that, we need your support, so please donate a few dollars to TalkRadio1.com. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. Thank you so much for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. I am Stephen Spear. Throughout the country and around the world, this is TalkRadio1.com.